Well, it's good to be with you once again after a year's break to get over my last visit. Every time Steve goes away, it's kind of him to ask us to come back and to fill in some of the Sundays when he's away. And usually he does this very early in the year so that he's actually quick before my diary gets invaded with other illustrious invitations to come and take a morning service. And one of the things he does every year is he requests that in some form we have a series of addresses rather than just something from here and there. And as you know, over the last few years we've endeavoured to do that, and this year is no exception. I think he's just testing me to see whether we can come up with series, and I wouldn't be surprised if he doesn't note them and goes home and keep them in a catalogue for the future. But this morning we begin a little series for the weeks when Steve's away until he returns, just four Sundays, in which we're going to take from the New Testament, from the occasions when the writers invite us to consider. Consider something together. And we're going to pick up, there are many more than four, but we're going to pick up on just four of those occasions. And if you want a title for the series, it would be New Testament Considerations. New Testament Considerations. Four occasions when we're asked to consider together. And this morning we're exploring one such. It comes from Hebrews 12 and from verse 3, where we read these words. Consider him. And the focus that the writer has in mind is Jesus. Consider him. Consider Jesus, who endured such opposition from sinful men, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. A group of people who were losing heart, that the writer asks to consider Jesus, who lies at the very centre of their faith and their relationship with God. Don't think about the difficulties, says the writer. Focus on Jesus. Consider him. Don't be overawed by the opposition. Consider Jesus. Consider him. Don't let those Jewish protagonists drag you off in the wrong direction. Look again at Jesus, who lies at the very centre of your relationship with God. And so we're going in a way to do that this morning. Not with high theological exposition, not with that kind of Bible study depth, but considering Jesus in a way I hope we can carry you with us. And maybe just excite and expand a little bit that sometimes gets taken for granted. There were six things that we were going to consider, but I thought we needed to get home for dinner time. So we've got five, which means you'll get home in time to turn the roast on or whatever. Five things I'd like us to consider about this character that lies at the very heart of our Christian faith. Consider Jesus. First of all, let's consider his consummate uniqueness. Something consummately unique about Jesus. When you stand back and maybe in a headline tabloid way, take a look at his life and the lives of other religious leaders or great leaders of this world. You see, Jesus was not like some of these at all when you take a little look at him. He wasn't born in a family of privilege and wealth that opened up to him education and advantage, as some of those leaders of the past have done. This was a man who was born in total obscurity, in a little place called Nazareth. Well, Bethlehem, but Nazareth was where he grew up. Which was why when Philip discovered Jesus and he went to Nathanael and told him where he came from, he said, "Can anything good come from Nazareth?" That was the kind of obscurity into which Jesus was born. He wasn't born into some great town that offered him some illustrious tag. He wasn't born in Florence or Rome or Jerusalem. He was raised as a child in an obscure parochial Palestinian backwater called Nazareth. And he didn't have an illustrious family to fall back on, who were town councillors, mayors, or leading citizens. He was born into a carpenter's home. A carpenter's home. And like his father, he followed into the carpentry business. A carpenter. He was someone who never travelled far. He never travelled more than 200 miles from where he was born. His furthest trip was probably down into Egypt with his parents when he became, for a brief while, a refugee, probably remembering little of that experience. He grew up in this home in Nazareth, in obscurity, as a carpenter for 30 years. And he began a ministry that only lasted for 3 more years. He never married. He never had a dynasty that he gave birth to. He had no family leaders as far as that is concerned. And one of the most amazing things was his public ministry was as short and sharp as it was. Now, when you compare that with some of the others that have left some historical trace, it's quite strange. Buddha was 80 years old when he finally passed away. Confucius was 72. And Muhammad was 62. Jesus died at the age of 33. Yet with such a short life and ministry, Jesus changed the course of human history. This is a unique character that lies at the heart of the faith we have. And despite all the attempts since of despots and dictators to rid the world of whatever influence he had, persecuting his followers, killing them, burning the very book in which the record of his life was contained, here we are 2,000 years and more, gathered together in Parsons Heath, and at the heart of our faith is this unique, this consummately unique character of Jesus. It's something to go home and ask ourselves about. How unique this man was, young and short in ministry, who could leave his mark on the calendar of time in the way he has done. Amazing. Unique. No one else in history has ever lived a life like his life. The second thing to note, and I want us to consider, is the character of Jesus. Just for a moment, let us consider what we're told of the character of the one that we come to worship this morning. Ordinary and human to the very core, though Jesus was, there was something very significant about the character of Jesus. For the Bible tells us that indefinably and inexplainably, God stepped into this world in the person of Jesus. That God himself stepped into this world in the person of Jesus. It never happened before and will never happen again. Once in all time, God stepped in. A conundrum for philosophers and theologians from Jesus' time onwards have puzzled and argued and endeavoured to get their limited little weak human minds around that concept. But in Jesus, in the character of Jesus, there is something else going on. God stepped into this world in Jesus in a wonderful and inexplicable way. John, when he opens his gospel, introduces the one he knows so well. John was one of Jesus' closest companions. And he writes about him, introducing him as the Word. And you need to read much more of it to really get the feel of it. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. And the Word, there's those amazing words, was God. He was in the beginning with God, the pre-existent nature of Jesus. Through him, all things were made. He was there at the creative touch of God, involved in it all. And the Word, he says, became flesh, and it dwelt among us, full of grace and truth, and we beheld the glory of it. And John's gospel, along with the other gospels, are the testimony of that. Now, just a moment. It is one of those things that our modern world questions about Jesus. The fact that these miracles happened, he did the things he did. But surely if what we are being told is the truth, that God stepped in Jesus, one would surely expect that he did the things he did. How else could he still the storm if he was not the creator of the world? How else could he have changed the water into wine? How else could he have healed the sick and raised Lazarus back to life again? It was because of who he was. Little flashes like firework going off to tell us something is happening here that has never happened before and is not going to happen again. God in our world, wearing our skin and breathing our air. Human to the core, though this character was. God stepped in, and God stepped in a wonderful way. You remember those words we go back to at Christmas that tell us about the coming of Jesus long before he came, that the child was to be born. And his titles were to be Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Written and hinted before he came, God was going to do something and he was going to step into this world. So consider that consummate uniqueness of Jesus. No one like him. Consider the character of Jesus. Human though he was, there was the flip side in which God stepped in. The third thing I want us to reflect on and to consider is the compassion of this man. In the light of who he was, and what he came to do, let's consider something that marked his ministry and his life in a most amazing way. The compassion of this man. Unlike many religious leaders and conquerors that have come and gone, this was a man whose life was marked by compassion. He was no bloodthirsty revolutionary. He was no despotic tyrant bent on whipping people into line. He was no religious fanatic that whipped up such trouble others paid the price with their own lives and in their own blood. No, this man's life was marked by compassion in what he said and what he did. He touched the untouchable, the leper. He touched those that his society rejected. He shared the company of social outcasts like the tax collector, so much so he was called, as an insult, the friend of sinners. He kept bad company. He showed compassion and restraint on that moment when flung before him was a woman caught in the very act of adultery, and the baying crowd wanted to see her stoned there and then. Compassion marked this man's life and ministry. Jesus, in his message, talked about forgiveness. And what do you find at that moment when he was crucified? Father, forgive, for they know not what they do. He talked the talk and walked the walk. Jesus talked about redemption. And there in that barbecue breakfast after the resurrection, you see him setting a few moments aside to talk to Peter, who had denied he even knew him 3 times, having said he would stick it out to the end and die for him if necessary. And Jesus deals with the failure, deals with the sinful side of that event, and says to Peter, follow me, follow me. The redemptive compassion of Jesus in the face of his honourable friends. Denial of knowing him. Jesus talked about love, a supreme love. He said the greatest love was for a man to lay down his life for his friends. And having said it, we see him do it. The compassion that marked this man. It's not the kind of thing you equate with the usual run-of-the-mill leader who wants to bring in some kingdom and rule of his. And yet it marked the life of Jesus, and his compassion reaches out to you and to me in our frailty and in our sin, in our longing to be more than we have the capability to be. He is compassionate and says, follow me, follow me. And Jesus came to that consummate moment, did he not, of crucifixion. And that's the fourth thing I want us to consider, because it's a strange turn of fate in such a life and in such a character. Consider the crucifixion of Jesus in how it fits in the jigsaw of what's going on. Now, there have been those who have talked about the crucifixion of Jesus as a kind of miscalculation on Jesus's part. He overstepped the mark and he got the chop. A tragedy, a life cut short. A mammoth miscalculation that cost him his life. No, no, no. That's not how Jesus saw it. He, from the very beginning,
knew how it was going to end.
As you read Mark's gospel, as he tells us about the character of Jesus, three times Jesus shared with them what was going to happen. And in chapter 8 and 31, he says, he began teaching them that the Son of Man, meaning himself, must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed, and after 3 days, rise again. He spoke plainly about this. And again in chapter 9, 31, he says similar things. And again in chapter 10, 32 to 34, he spells it out yet again. He knew God was going to do something in his life at the very end through his death that would be timeless. And it was a man who saw that he had come not to write books, although many have been written about him, not to be just a great leader that people would follow until he died at a ripe old age. No, Jesus came with his consciousness that there would come a moment when he would die, and die to make forgiveness justly possible for folk like you and I. That was part of the plan. His death opened the door that made a new life possible. On the very cross where he died, he said to that thief, "Today, you will be with me in paradise." An opened door through his death. As the clouds gathered and the darkness crept in at those moments, as the earth trembled observably beneath their feet, and the very curtain in the temple was rent in two, the hand of God was poking through, reaching out to all who would see in Jesus the one who could atone for their sin, for they couldn't do it for themselves. The one who could bring them into a new relationship with God, who could break the powerful hold Satan had on humanity, offer them life in all its fullness. And his death was the very thing that made it possible. This was no mistake. The character we look at was a unique character. It was a character in which God stepped into the world. His life and ministry was marked by compassion, which reaches out to you and I. And his death was no accident. It was part of the plan. Finally, the fifth thing I want us just to consider is the fact that he talked of a kingdom that he was going to bring. A kingdom. A king of a kingdom. He was to usher in, and all who came to faith in him, who coronated him as king of their lives, who accepted him as saviour, were brought into that kingdom. Kingdom in the hearts of men. A kingdom in which Christ was king. Now, our world has seen a number of kingdoms. Those of you who are keen on history will probably be able to put the dates to some of these. But where is that great kingdom in the Old Testament that was the Persian kingdom? Where, indeed, is that kingdom Alexander the Great, who two-thirds of the world conquered before he was 30? One of the greatest demonstrations of kingdom building there's ever been. Where is that kingdom now? Where is the illustrious Roman kingdom that came and encompassed most of Europe and more? Where is the Ottoman kingdom? Where is the British kingdom? Do you remember the map on the wall in school? And the red, the great British kingdom. Kingdoms come and kingdoms go. But the interesting thing about the kingdom Jesus set up is it is still here. And we are part of it together. It's a kingdom which 2,000 years on has never grown faster than in recent history. 142,000 people are estimated to commit their lives to Christ every day around the world. 142,000 people. Around the world, 100 churches a week open to accommodate that growing number of people. In a year, that's 36,500. It's a growing and expanding kingdom that this kingdom you and I belong to is. And at the present rate, nearly a third of the world's population profess in some way or other to follow the teaching of Jesus. What a character lies at the heart of the faith we possess. He has a consummate uniqueness, a divine character, one we cannot fully plumb the depths. A life marked with compassion, and one that reaches out to you and I, who laid down his life, and that was the beginning of something that made everything else possible, a kingdom into which we can come. And we can not only grow, but God grant that we may see other people coming into that kingdom and growing in it themselves. Let's just pray together.